Welcome to the Watering Hole, Stephen Wright. It is such an honor and a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And really, such a privilege and an honor. You have delighted, dare I say, millions? I dared. And not just with your stand-up, but movies, writing, directing, producing. You're an author and a musician, question mark?
Yeah, I do some music, yeah. Where did you see that?
Well, when I saw you in One Soldier, you were playing the concertina?
Oh, yes.
And do you play the concertina?
No. I made that movie, I made the little theme song up on a guitar, and I thought the concertina would be better in the movie. But I fool around with music. I have a website, and I have a couple of songs on there. They're not funny songs. It's something I do for my own enjoyment.
Yes, and so you don't actually do, say, a Steve Martin and go out and hook up with Jackson Brown and go on concert
tours? No, I do. I do it for, just with some guys I know in a recording studio and just for the fun of it.
Awesome. Wow. Okay. So where do I go from here? Your influences are Carlin and Woody Allen, Groucho Marx. I don't even know where to start with any of this.
Well, not really Groucho Marx. Let me say that I'm from Massachusetts, and I was a Boston Bruins fan during the Bobby Orr days, so I would listen to the games on my radio when I was in bed, and then one time I was fooling with the dial and I stumbled on this Boston radio show where the guy played two entire comedy albums every Sunday night, and then and it was right when I had become very interested in stand-up comedy from watching Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show, and I was very taken by that guy coming out and talking about life in a funny way, his interpretation, and then talking to Johnny Carson. I was really like, wow, that's something I think I would like to do. So right around that same time, by coincidence, I stumbled on that show. And I knew Carlin already. He's my main hero guy of why I wanted to do stand-up. I mean, the Class Clown and those albums were like, I knew them, but I didn't know. But this guy who played Sunday nights, he had the most huge collection of comedy, and he played people I knew and people I never knew. And I knew Woody Allen is also one of my heroes, and I knew his movies, but I didn't even know he did stand up. And so I'd be laying in bed in the dark, studying it, really, without knowing it. I didn't know I was studying it. I'd be thinking, oh, I like what that guy does. Oh, I don't really care for that. So Woody Allen, that album really struck me on, like, he told stories, but he had jokes within the stories. I mean, I just enjoyed hearing, the 2,000-year-old man with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and everything, like David Fry and John Biner and David Brenner and
David Brenner. Oh my gosh.
So later, when I actually started to do comedy, I would talk, George Carlin influenced me in that I would talk about everyday things. Mm-hmm. At the time, those early albums, about God and politics and
right.
stuff. It was everyday
right.
stuff. So when I went on stage, that's what I talked about, but in doing a different thing than he did with the everyday things, and then learning how to write a joke from Woody Allen, and those were my two main influences.
So did you knew from an early age that this is what you wanted to do?
Yes, from about 16.
Were your parents funny?
No, not really. I mean, they weren't, like, not funny. You know, that's
they were Catholic, right? So, there's a certain self-effacing humor that lies underneath all of that.
They were just regular. Like my, I have an older brother. He's 3 years older than me, and we would be up on Friday nights, upstairs. Everyone else is in bed, and we had to watch what he wanted because he controlled the television because he was older than me, and he liked Johnny Carson. So then I had to watch Johnny Carson. But as it went on, then I loved it. So when I was 16 was like when I got that dream, like, oh man, that's what I would like to do, but thinking it will never really happen. But that's when it got in my head.
And 8 years later, you're on the Carson show.
Yeah, 82. I was
24, 26, 26. So now your brother has to watch you on Carson, which is awesome. I used to have to be the antenna for my brother to watch hockey. You know, stand there. That's where you stand. And I seriously, but only for about 4 years.
What team?
Well, we're Rangers. You're Boston. Sorry, buddy. I don't know what to say. We're next year Celtics. And man, I miss those old rivalries. The sports is so different today. That's amazing to know at an early age what you want to do and then to succeed at it, you know. And it's obviously, I mean, to write a joke, because my stuff, what I do with the improv is on the spot. I don't preconceive it, and I don't get to test it out.
Jesus.
So you mentioned Woody Allen, and I, obviously Carlin, but Woody Allen, I have to say, when I watched your two short movies, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings with Rowan Atkinson and One Soldier, my first thought, and this is before, like I said, I'm not a fanboy kind of person. I don't do deep dives. But then after I watched the films, I'm like, well, what is going on here? Because I saw Woody Allen in those movies. I saw the way it was shot. I was reminded of Love and Death. Like where he's playing chess with death, you know, and dancing through this forest. It's just weird shots. And where was that shot? Where were those two movies shot?
Appointments of Dennis Jennings is all in New York. The other one, One Soldier, was in New England, Block Island, New Hampshire, Massachusetts. You know, like everyone's head, even if you think of music, musicians have these influences. Everyone has these influences, and then it gets mixed in with their own mind like a soup. It's like a soup all mixed together. So that's why, my influences are there,
And I also, I saw Monty Python in there, like Terry Gilliam. The whole... I think it was The Appointments. Where you're looking at the TV and you're just sitting on the couch.
Oh, yeah.
And then the old man's looking back at you and he calls his old lady in. And they're looking at you and you're looking at them. And I'm like, what is happening right now? I felt like I was watching Brazil, you know, that Terry. It was just so weird. I loved it. I laughed out loud.
Surrealism. Oh, good.
Did you study film?
No, but I loved Surrealism. In college, I became aware of that, you know, Salvador Dali and all that. And Monty Python is like surrealistic comedy. Layers of realities that would never happen. But yeah, I'm glad that you thought it was Monty Python influence. But I'm not thinking, you know.
I know.
Thinking, oh, this is my.
No, of course
you're
not.
You're just doing.
Yeah, right, like, right. I saw this woman interview I.M. Pei, the architect, and she asked him, you know, how did you get the dimensions for the glass pyramid in front of the Louvre so perfect? And he said, it just felt right. You know? I mean, and I was like, yeah, that's it. It's perfect. And so again, interviewing you for 15 minutes feels like, oh, let's take a picture of Stephen Wright. And there it is. It's like, no, it's none of those. And it's all of those, right? I couldn't believe all the stuff that you were in. I mean, you've worked with so many people. Rowan Atkinson, how was that working with him?
Oh, that was incredible because, I mean, me and my friend Mike Armstrong, my college buddy we met in college, we wrote that script. And we didn't know, and the HBO was going to do it with, I think, the BBC. So that's how... Rowan Atkinson even got into our mind. But what was good about was him. We didn't notice that the psychiatrist, it's about a guy, in case people don't know, it's about a guy who kills his own psychiatrist. And I'm the patient. And Rowan Atkinson was a psychiatrist. But when we wrote it, weren't aware that he didn't even have a lot of lines. He didn't have a ton of lines. We didn't even notice that. But Rowan Atkinson is so much with his face that it didn't matter. His face is incredible. He's, you know, one of the great comedians, just amazing. And we were so lucky to have him in there.
Yeah, you've been all these things. You've been a stand-up comedian. You've done writing, producing, directing, acting, TV, movies. Do you have a favorite one of these things? Is there a particular?
I think the stand-up is the favorite, probably, because the thoughts, a really nice, interesting thought is just exciting, you know, and you don't know if it's going to work. I mean, you have to try it out. I try them out. Only one in four or one in three jokes that I write, it gets a big enough laugh to stay in my act. So, I mean, that's most of them don't work. So, like a baseball player, if he's batting 300,
that's pretty good.
That's good, but he's getting out 7 times out of 10. But, I mean, I'm just talking about weeding it out, weeding through them. A thought comes into your head and you just write it down and then you just say it. It's so immediate. It's so quick. There's no phone calls. There's no meetings. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's just really pure.
And there's something
and
about
fun. It's fun, right, too.
Well, there's a put and a call, right? I mean, there's that response with the audience in front of you, and that's how you know. I've seen you, and it's a rare thing where you smirk, like you almost laugh. It's like, ooh, they got him, you know, because they really laughed at it. Oh, man.
Yeah, I get amused by them being amused. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The idea of thinking about thinking. I have issues with that myself. I relate. It doesn't stop.
Oh, and so, the one told you when she said he's thinking too much?
Yeah, just stop thinking. Yeah. Stop. It's like,
you can't.
I'm thinking about stopping thinking. I'll get right on that. You know?
It's fun talking to you. Yeah, well, how long have you had your comedy show there?
Almost a couple of years now, maybe a year and a half. Yeah, I'd never... Radio is so different from what it is that I'm actually trained in, which again is improv, and with radio there's nobody else in the room, so I have no idea how any of my stuff is landing ever.
Oh yeah.
Unless somebody calls. Yeah. And usually that's not good. You know, when they call it's like, ooh, okay. So
fantastic.
But you suffer from the same I suffer from, where it's just thinking and observing life, like, it's absurd. You have such a way with language, even just the camera angles in your movies are strange and weird, and it's how I want to see the cow walking across the field. What is happening right now? Why is walking across the field?
I started drawing and painting way before I ever wrote any comedy. Like growing up, drawing, painting in high school, surrealism after high school. So my visual sense is the first thing I've ever did creatively. And then when you draw something realistically, which I did for many years, you really notice the details in something that you wouldn't notice if you weren't drawing it. Like if there was a wine bottle on a table next to a glass, you would see the shape of the wine bottle, shape of the glass, but then you'd also notice the shape in between them, which is its own shape, and you wouldn't, well, there's no reason to even notice that unless that you're trying to help it get it accurate. And I think all of that accidentally exercise my mind to notice things in general, because the comedy is from noticing. Mm-hmm. You're just noticing in the world, and I just have fun, you know, I just have fun making stuff up. It's an endless thinking thing. I don't see it as an ordeal at all. It's just, you're just like hanging out in your own mind. Oh, look at that, oh, that, you know.
Yeah, you speak of the space between objects, and that being its own shape and its own space, and the relationship between the three, really, the two objects and the space between, they all have an interplay as well. There's a cadence to your stand-up that is very similar to that there's a silence, there's a waiting. I relish the silence in the improv skits where it's just connection. You know, you kind of, you just wait for it to land, and then you go, you know, and there's such a...
Yeah, the silence is definitely something. It's sounds like it isn't anything, but it is. I learned, you know, doing stand-up when I would forget what was coming next or something. I would just be standing there for 3 seconds trying to remember, but I noticed that I held the audience's attention anyway. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to do this on purpose. Just put in long, extra long silences mm-hmm. just to build attention.
You wrote this book called Herald. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, I just started writing something for no reason. I wasn't trying to write a book right then. I like to write anything that comes into my head. And I started writing about a kid in third grade named Harold. And I was just making it up, and it just started getting longer, and I thought, well, this is interesting. Let me see, because I never wrote a book before, and I just said, let me see how long I can do this, still not thinking it would be a book. But then as I went along, I realized that I could use his head, Harold's head, I could put a funnel on his head, and I could pour into his head many, many things that I think about life that couldn't be put into jokes, like my short jokes. I could put in what I think of the universe and evolution and war and religion, and I pour all this stuff into have him thinking this. The book is, he's in class in third grade, and it's all what happens in one day in school in his head. It's like his theories, of course, what's happening in the classroom, the teacher, the other students. He's thinking about his grandfather, and he's thinking about dreams he had, and he's looking out the window, and he's thinking about just constantly thinking. And then, so then I thought, I'll just use him to express all this stuff that I have never couldn't say on stage. And the big part of the thing was he has an analogy. Harold has an analogy that the inside of his head is like full of thousands and thousands of birds, little tiny birds, like it's an indoor planetarium. Mm-hmm. Like, and each bird represents a thought, a single thought. And then there's a little rectangular window in the middle of his head. And if the bird flies through there randomly for no reason, whatever thought that is, that's what Harold starts thinking about. So his mind, he's constantly jumping around, but he's also thinking things without the birds. And that's it. That's it. I really enjoyed writing it.
I feel like you really captured the child staring out the window in the classroom and a whole world, a whole universe is available, and then he looks back at the clock and only 5 minutes have gone by. What was the process?
Well, I get high on coffee, and I exercise every morning. I ride a bike. I'm a bike guy. And so then I would ride the bike, get some coffee, and go somewhere. I wrote it on my phone, actually. I wrote the book on my phone because I could be anywhere. I could be in my car. I could be out in the woods. I was at the top of a ski resort. I was like, because I could never write it in a room because I need to be seeing stuff. You know, the room is so boring. Anyway, I started writing it, and as I wrote it, I enjoyed what I was writing, and I looked forward the next day to going to this thing. It wasn't like a task. I liked going to it. And the fact that I sat there for like an hour and a half trying to think of something, it was different for me because the jokes just come into my head. But the fact I sat there, even if I couldn't think of anything, and waited for something to happen. So I thought of stuff I never would have thought of had I not been on this routine. And jokingly, I said to my friends that writing a book is like reading a book that has something wrong with it because it keeps ending.
It was such a pleasure to read that book. And again, every page, it was a profound, this is so weird. When we talked last time and I asked you about the birds, you're like, yeah, I know nothing about birds.
You know, like five birds. So I had like you know, then this bird, then this bird.
Were you making them up, or did you look them up?
Yes.
You were making up birds.
After I got rid of done with the 5 or 7 birds, then I was just making up birds, and that was a whole other hilarity for myself.
You were having fun. You were having fun, right.
Making the name up, making the characteristics up.
Well, did you know that I actually thought they were all real birds?
I didn't
never look them up. I just assumed you were a birder, and now it's like even funnier. It's funnier on top of, I love the layers of it. So is it in any way biographical? I mean, your whole relationship with your grandfather?
No, there was no, I don't have that in my real life with the grandfather. That's made up. But I love the idea of an older guy hanging out with a young person, because the old guy is like almost done. He's almost leave. If you put it like a circle, like he's almost at the end. He's going to leave soon. And the boy is in the beginning, but they're near each other in the circle. You know, like one guy knows everything, the experience and everything. He knows everything, meaning he knows he doesn't even know really much. That's how smart he is.
Exactly.
And then the little kid doesn't know anything. There's a connection somehow.
Yeah.
I like the older guy and the young boy. There's an innocence to them. Even the guy's old, there's an innocence to he you know, this whole experience of being alive. And then the kid is just starting out. I just love that combination. So that was all. There is no real grandfather like that. But that concept, I've loved that for many, many years. In my stand-up, there's references to grandfather.
At what point in your life did you realize you knew enough to know you knew nothing? For me, it was unfortunately way too late. Which is, it's so interesting that you say that to me, because I was thinking about this morning on the way up here, and it is a complete circle in that regard. I mean, to the point of even physicality, right? Because we both wind up in diapers at some relationship there,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Like, you know, I don't know. As you get older, you realize, wait a minute. You know, there's so much. It's endless. To know what there's endless of stuff to learn. You get to an age where it's like, wait a minute, I don't really know. I know a few basic things.
Yeah. What I see is repetition, because I love history, and I just, it's the same story to me for several thousand years now, at least as far as what was written down and the stories we tell each other, because I believe that's all we really are, is a collection of stories. That is what our identity is.
Right.
One of my favorite things, I never thought of this. I thought of it in a different way. But in One Soldier, you paint 5 lines on your reading glasses. And then you look up at the stars and play the stars on your concertina. And that image
The stars became notes on the line.
Oh. That image to me is so incredible. And then you played it. It was so beautiful. Let's go back to the book really quickly. You go to the moon and you're hanging out with Carl Sagan.
In a dream, a long dream. Yes.
What is the relationship with Carl Sagan, if I may ask? Did you ever meet Carl Sagan?
No, but I used to see him on The Tonight Show all the time.
Sure, yeah.
As a guest. And, you know, as the book was going along, I don't know why, he thought he had a dream. Oh, I know, he could be on the moon. And then when you think of the moon, you think of the planets. And when you think of the planets, you think of Carl Sagan. And it's like, oh, wow, okay. Now he can be on the moon with Carl Sagan in a spaceship. Carl Sagan has his own spaceship. Total surrealism. He's bringing 500 merry-go-round horses to God. I mean, it's insane.
Merry-go-round horses freak me out, Stephen.
They do.
Why? It's like clowns, like a scary clown, those things. When you look at them closely, they're, because I grew up in New York, right? And those old school merry-go-rounds, you look at the horses and they are like the 4 horses of the apocalypse, you know? It's terrifying.
Yeah, you're right.
They're very gothic, and it's just, oh, I don't want to ride a horse like that. And, you put this three-year-old on this thing that's just like breathing fire. And you're like, oh, my God, no.
You never saw it like
that. Oh, it's terrifying. It's true, and then you've got him on the moon. I'm like, oh, with Carl Sagan, no. Yeah, I loved it. I loved that book. And so I
thank you so much.
I don't know if I'm allowed to push it.
Things like so many weird things. Like I'm thought of merry-go-round horses. I don't know why. And then I'm talking about Harold's thinking if you did a drawing of a merry-go-round horse or a drawing of a real horse, if you looked at them, they would be the same because they're both drawings, even though one is from a fake horse and one is from a real horse. So it's like you can't, they're both fake on real. It was just like mine was like just making stuff up. I just had fun doing it.
It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Stephen Wright. Thank you so much for doing this interview. It's been a dream come true.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I hope you have fun with your radio show and your improv. Thank you very much. Really good talking to you. I appreciate it.
Aloha.